Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Earlier this month, U.S. President Joe Biden signed the CHIPS and Science Act, a bill purportedly meant to revive U.S. dominance in research and development. We used to rank number one in the world in R&D. Now we rank number nine, Biden said at the signing ceremony. China was number eight decades ago. Now they are number two. And a recent study from Japan's science ministry reported that China now leads the world not just in quantity of scientific research, but in quality too. The success of the U.S. and perhaps China into the future is due to the research university, an academic institution that offers professors the freedom to study and to research, and students the freedom to learn, leading to high-quality academic output. Those universities are the subject of empires of ideas, creating the modern university from Germany to America to China, written by Professor William Kirby and published by Harvard University Press. William Kirby is Spangler Family Professor of Business Administration and T.M. Chang Professor of China Studies at Harvard University, as well as Chair of the Harvard China Fund and Faculty Chair of the Harvard Center Shanghai. His many books include Can China Lead? Reaching the Limits of Power and Growth. Today, Bill and I talk about the research university, Humboldt, Harvard, Berkeley, Tsinghua, Nanjing, and University of Hong Kong. We'll also discuss what it means for China and China institutions to play a bigger role in world academia. How might that change things? So, Bill, thank you so much for joining me today on the Asian Review of Books podcast. I'd like to start with a simple question. Why write a book about the university and the research university specifically?
Well, thank you very much, Nicholas, for having me on the podcast. It's a great question. Of course, if you're a scholar at a university, as I have been for 40 years, then, of course, being interested in universities and how they work is important. I've been fortunate to work in great research universities as well and on three continents. But this book came out of several intersecting events. One was the time that I served as Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences here at Harvard, where I came to know this university and our competitors extremely well. Arts and Sciences at Harvard is about half of Harvard University. But then also the experience I had, I went to the 200th anniversary of the founding of the first great research university, the University of Berlin, founded in 1810, and a university that would become the model for all serious universities in the next two centuries. And I went to this 200th anniversary, and the president of the university, now called the Humboldt University, welcomed all of the guests by saying, and I quote, "Nobody would take my university as a model for anything today." And I began to think, of course, he was very quickly no longer the president of Humboldt University, saying this on his way out, as it were. But I began to think of how do not just countries, but also universities and university systems rise and fall. I'd been educated in the United States, in Germany, and in Greater China. I have worked in universities in all three countries. And the fact is that German universities set global standards without question in the 19th and early 20th century. They were absolutely the best. American universities by the end of the 20th century were very widely believed to be the global leaders. And the question then is, in this realm, as in others, will China be the one that defines excellence in the 21st century? This is about the rise and fall of nations in some sense through the work of universities or through the lens, I think it is better said, of universities, by the institutions that really are both internal and external metrics of success and influence. And when you think about it, there isn't a country that has been a leading power from the 18th century on. Think of France in the 18th century, Germany and Britain in the 19th century, the United States in the 20th century, that has not also been a pace setter and a trend setter in culture and in education. So it has to do with where we have been and where we are going.
So maybe it's worth asking a definitional question, which is kind of what exactly is a research university in your view?
Okay, well, the major distinction, universities are uralt, as the Germans would say. And of course, they date to medieval times, the oldest ones in Italy. You have enduringly great universities in Britain, like Oxford and Cambridge. But it was the invention of the modern research university in Berlin, beginning in 1810, by Wilhelm von Humboldt, who believed that a university was a place not simply to transmit, but to create knowledge, to create scientific research. The term Wissenschaft used equally in, whether it's in the humanities and social sciences, as in the natural sciences, the beginning of a scientific revolution in the world of universities. German universities were not particularly distinguished in this realm before the founding of the University of Berlin. And it's founded not formally as the national university, but founded at a moment of national weakness in the case of Prussia. Prussia had lost a major set of battles with Napoleon, and King Frederick William III said something rather remarkable for a political leader anywhere. He said, "We will replace with intellectual strength what we have lost in physical strength." And he deputed Humboldt, and Humboldt recruited others to found and to recruit to Berlin the greatest minds and greatest scholars and researchers across Germany. And over the course of the 19th century, a call to Berlin became the high point of any academic's career, of course, largely to Germans, because it's a German-speaking university. And German universities educated the leaders of American universities in the 19th century and early 20th century. Very difficult to get a professorship in a leading American research university in the late 19th century without a German degree, or at least without having studied in Germany. And so there are many other things that have defined that university by Humboldt. One is what I just mentioned, the focus on research and the integration of research and teaching, the unity of research and teaching. A second feature was academic autonomy, the capacity of a university to make its own academic decisions by and large, even if state funded. Third, the centrality of the philosophical faculty, what we would call the faculty of arts and sciences in the United States, in leading a university. And finally, what Humboldt called Lehrfreiheit and Lernfreiheit, the freedom to teach and the freedom to learn, is setting out standards of academic freedom that have marked great universities everywhere since that time. Never perfectly enacted in Berlin or in any other German university, but it is a remarkable invention of an institution that is in many ways new in the 19th century.
So what exactly was it about the German universities that so influenced American universities? And actually, how did that influence actually get expressed when American universities were growing in the 19th century? In early 20th century, I mean.
Well, American universities have been around a long time.
You know, yes.
Harvard was founded in the late Ming Dynasty by Chinese historical terms. And it was a fine college emulating British collegiate life and education with a required curriculum, but never cutting edge and never devoted to the creation of knowledge until it began to emulate counterparts in Germany. Now, Hopkins, Johns Hopkins University, the University of Chicago, were the first to wholeheartedly embrace the German model and would be founded as graduate schools. And it isn't until at Harvard, the founding of the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences and the sending of many Harvard faculty to Germany for continuing education, as it were, that Harvard became a university worthy of its name. It had been called a university since the 1630s, but it was really a college with a few small professional schools. But it became a serious research university in the second half of the 19th century by emulating the German model. Take the example of Stanford. Stanford University, founded in the latter part of the 19th century also, has as its motto, a German motto, Die Luft der Freiheit weht, the wind of freedom blows. Not too many Stanford graduates today can probably pronounce that motto, but it is there on many buildings on that beautiful campus. And it is really through until, I would say, it would be fair to say, if we had rankings, university rankings, then, as we have today, probably, certainly as late as 1913, but probably as late as the 1920s, 8 of the top 10 universities in the world would be ranked as German universities, with the other two being Oxford and Cambridge. And Harvard and its American counterparts would be lucky to be in the top 20 or 30.
So I do want to ask one question about Harvard, and I will admit that I am a Harvard alumnus of the college, not of the graduate schools. But, you know,
of Harvard, whom we are very proud.
Thank you. But you know, but Harvard has this place now where it's kind of like, if you ask a lot of people around the world, kind of what is the world's best university? A lot of people outside of the U.S. would say Harvard. But that's obviously a reputation that's been built up over years, over decades, with a lot of people working together, to build up that reputation, that stature, that status. But also a reputation that kind of covers a lot of Harvard's mistakes, some of which you kind of get at in your book. So I do want to just ask a question about, like, how has Harvard, and I know it's hard to do in just one question, but how has Harvard been able to capture this status, this reputation as one of the, if not the world's premier academic institution?
It's a great and very complicated question. I'll try to handle it reasonably quickly. Of course, it's the oldest university in the United States. And as one of the two leading universities in New England, it educated, as by default, not too many other places to go, many of the American elite, particularly the 18th and 19th centuries. And yet it becomes, its international renown really has to do with the strength, not just of the college, which, or even primarily of Harvard College, which is an undergraduate institution, almost exclusively, historically 90%+ for those already residing in the United States. But it's the growth of its professional schools and its Graduate School of Arts and Sciences that recruits the best and the brightest from around the world. It's also the result of leadership, extraordinary leadership. The 40-year presidency of Charles Eliot, who takes really a quite parochial college and with a few reasonably distinguished professional schools and makes it into a major research university by the turn of the 20th century. And his successors, long-term successful presidencies of 20 years plus thereafter, solidify that reputation. And resources, of course, matter, but a call to Harvard by the end, really by the middle of the 20th century, is very much like a call to Berlin in the 19th century. But the lesson to take from this is a call to Berlin was without peer, without question, the epitome of a scholar's life in the 19th century. One could say the same for Harvard by the end of the 20th century. And yet Berlin is not in that situation today. The point here is that nothing lasts forever. Great institutions can fall as well as rise. The fall of Berlin is very closely tied, of course, with the tragedies of Germany in the first half of the 20th century. And in particular, if you recall that Stanford motto, die Luft der Freiheit weht, the wind of freedom blows, well, the wind of freedom in Germany stopped blowing altogether in 1933 as Germany descended into Nazism, and then for the Humboldt University into a very parochial form of Marxism-Leninism for the much of the history of the Humboldt University. And so the fate of universities is tied also to the fate of nations. So no institution stays strong by standing still, and it is a constant challenge for Harvard to reinvent itself. And there are many challenges, as anyone who reads this book, at Harvard that would be known to all who work and study here. The last thing I will say, and feel free, by the way, Nicholas, just to use which parts of this make the most sense, okay? The last thing that I shall say is that the reputation of Harvard, like that of Berlin, is greater the further away you are from it. I had one of my very best students, one of my very first students from mainland China, came from Sichuan, where she had been partly homeschooled by her mother. She was so bright and so accomplished that her family thought that she ought to study abroad. And the only university that they had heard of was Harvard. So she applied to Harvard, she gets in, and then her mother writes a book, Hafa Nuhai, Harvard Girl, effectively how my daughter got into Harvard, which would spawn all kinds of copycat books, Cornell Boy. There's one about our young, dumb little son gets into Oxford. There are many other. Anyway, when I was dean of the faculty, the mother and daughter came to see me to thank Harvard for her education. And I had bought a copy of that book, Harvard Girl, Hafa Nuhai, in Shanghai. And I asked them to autograph it for me. And they refused, because as it turns out, I had bought a pirated copy. And they had lost, you know, millions of sales to pirates. But they gave me a real copy very generously. And the mother is now a major proponent of intellectual property rights in China. So the Harvard education would have an interesting aftermath in that case.
Did they at least sign the real copy?
Absolutely, very generously.
There's something in there that I actually want to get at, and then I'd like to move on to the Chinese universities. But you had mentioned that earlier answer that like there hasn't been a single kind of power that hasn't had a strong research university component behind them. And that's clearly true looking at the American example. Harvard, the other universities are all wedded to the U.S. state, but also U.S. strengths in certain businesses. I mean, you can't talk about U.S. success in technology without talking about Stanford. How are universities and national power, economic power, how are these two things kind of wedded together?
Well, in the case of Harvard, but other leading American universities, very strongly, particularly beginning before, during, and above all, after the Second World War. Harvard has always been associated with the national narrative. George Washington had his headquarters in what is now the president's office in Massachusetts Hall, and colonial troops of the Continental Army were billeted in what is now Harvard Yard, the old yard. In the 1930s and 40s, Harvard faculty were mobilized for the war effort, for the Office of Strategic Services, the forerunner to the CIA. The Harvard president, James Conant, was active in recruiting scientists to work on the Manhattan Project. And this goes on in very serious hand-in-hand development of science and national power in the period of the Cold War, really until a fundamental break, at least from the point of view of the arts and sciences faculty and many students during the Vietnam War. But today, of course, federal funding for science is as important for Harvard as it is for any major research university. So it is tied to that national narrative in a very large way, as it in dollar terms, as in a way that had it not been for much of its first 300 years.
I'd like to move on to talk about the Chinese universities you discuss in your book. And I'm going to rather inartfully kind of combine the two mainland Chinese universities together, even though I know they're different, they have different histories, different focuses, different backgrounds. But you bring up two mainland Chinese universities in your book, Tsinghua and Nanjing. How do you see their stories kind of connected to the story of China?
Well, one, Tsinghua, of course, is in the northern capital in Beijing, which was the capital of the Qing when Tsinghua was founded as a prep school to send young Chinese to the United States with return box or indemnity money. And Nanjing University, of course, is in the southern capital, the capital that would become the capital of the Republic of China after 1927, a university with deep roots and multiple different roots, both from missionary colleges as well as from government institutions. And it became its central predecessor, National Central University, Guoli Zhongyang Dashi, became one of the two leading research universities with Tsinghua in the late 1920s and 1930s. And it is modeled very explicitly on the University of Berlin. This is a time of very close Chinese-German relations, the 1920s and the 1930s. And you know that Nanda, as it was not yet called, as Zhongyang Dashi was, Zhongyang Dashi was modeled on Berlin because it has a replica Brandenburg Gate welcome you onto the campus. And it's telling that this history still matters to Nanjing University, which would be forged out of these predecessors in 1952. Nanjing University, in its new campus outside of the city of Nanjing, has also erected a replica Brandenburg Gate in memory of National Central University and part of its lineage back to the great University of Berlin. So both of them, the point here is that both of them have international models and mentors to begin with. And at Tsinghua University, the first campus is modeled on the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, because it was the president of Urbana-Champaign that convinced the American president, Theodore Roosevelt, to remit Boxer indemnity funds to found Tsinghua. It becomes a great research university with international connections. My own teacher in graduate school, John Fairbank, I was basically his last graduate student. John Fairbank learned his Chinese history at Tsinghua University in the 1930s under the great scholar Jiang Tingfu, the chair of the history department there, a man who had go on to a very distinguished diplomatic career. Of course, you can see the transformation of almost every Chinese university in time, architecturally, by the different international influences. Tsinghua University looks like Urbana-Champaign in the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s. And then in the 1950s and 60s, it looks, at least its newer part, looks more like Moscow State, given the Soviet influence. But the broad point here is that the intellectual and architectural origins of every major Chinese university are international in origin. They have grown up as part of the world of universities and grown in strength by their interaction with the world of universities.
You know, you personally have had a lot of experience kind of working with Chinese universities, working with Chinese higher education. I wonder if you might kind of share some of your own personal experience kind of seeing these universities grow and develop, especially in the past, I guess, few years, few decades?
Well, I've had great opportunities in this. In Hong Kong, I served for a decade on the University Grants Committee, and I've been very active working with the University of Hong Kong on a board of Chinese University of Hong Kong, with Hong Kong Baptist University, and with Hong Kong Polytechnic University. But I came to know that sector extremely well from the work on UGC. I've advised Duke University. I was the Duke senior advisor on China in the establishment of Kunshan Duke Dashui, Duke Kunshan University, a university that said that it is, as your listeners may know, a liberal arts college, a residential liberal arts college in partnership with Wuhan University in Kunshan, one of the most entrepreneurial towns or small cities in China. And it's, if it is successful, as I very much hope it will be, it has the prospect of being the Yenjing University, another powerful private institution in the 20th century. It has the possibility of being the Yenjing University of the 21st century. At Tsinghua University, I've known colleagues at Tsinghua and at Beida, of course, for decades and decades, and I strongly admire both of those institutions. But I very early on was part of the conception and founding of what is now Schwarzman College, Sushimin Shuyuan, as an advisor to Steve Schwarzman and on the chairing the academic advisory board of Schwarzman scholars for both Mr. Schwarzman, but under the direction of President Chen Jining and President Chou Yong. And I watched this extraordinary operation go from concept to physical reality to an extraordinary program, the would-be Rhodes Scholarship of the 21st century. And the ambition on Tsinghua's part, think of it, how remarkable it is. This is a university that was founded in 1911 to send Chinese away for an education. Now with this Sushimin Shuyuan, Schwarzman Scholars, it has its ambition to bring the best and the brightest of the world to Tsinghua University. The ambition is that the best and the brightest of the world are not going to want a Rhodes Scholarship. Why go even to a wonderful place like Oxford, where you will be in a cold, drizzly, foggy, self-isolating island off the coast of Europe, when you could be in Beijing with beautiful blue skies, at least every other day?
So, eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You mentioned your work in Hong Kong, and I do want to kind of end our discussion of the various universities in your book with the University of Hong Kong. I am based in Hong Kong. In fact, the University of Hong Kong is like down the road from where I live. You know, it's a university that both is and is not in some ways, you know, Chinese. Hong Kong's had, has gone through a lot of changes in what it, well, changes in its status, in its stature in the world, and how it's seen in the world, certainly over the past 20 years, 25 years. How do you kind of see the future of the institution, you know, given Hong Kong's changing, complicated position?
Well, let me start by prefacing it and saying that in this book, I argue, you know, on the question, can Chinese universities lead the world in the 21st century? And the answer is a qualified yes, but not a perfect yes. Much depends on politics, and almost everything depends on the potential restraint of the Chinese Communist Party in the governing of great Chinese universities. We're in a moment of great tension right now, so this remains to be seen. So what distinguishes the university sector in Hong Kong is, of course, several things. Largely, but not exclusively, English speaking, so more internationally oriented even than their mainland counterparts, especially than their mainland counterparts, with a long and distinguished and separate history from the universities of the mainland. The University of Hong Kong is founded in the same year as Tsinghua University in 1911, founded, of course, as a British university and as the university of the colony and the university that really through the Second World War would educate virtually all of Hong Kong's elites that would be educated in Hong Kong. Since then, Hong Kong has developed a vibrant, really extraordinary higher education sector, very well funded, very well governed, particularly with this body of the University Grants Committee serving as a buffer between the government and the individual institutions, with a lot of both local as well as international talent advising it. And even today, Hong Kong has four universities ranked by the Times Higher Education in the top 100 in the world. HKU, number 30, CUHK, number 49, Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, number 66, PolyU, number 91. That's actually quite a remarkable achievement for such, such a compact place as Hong Kong. So these advantages, say the advantage of the University of Hong Kong, which Peter Matheson, the former vice chancellor, and Xiang Zhang, the current vice chancellor, really believe can be Asia's global university. This depends on first and foremost, and actually the greatness of every university depends first and foremost on the capacity for self-governance. And what had distinguished Hong Kong universities from mainland universities until recent times was the absolute guarantee of academic freedom, the absolute guarantee of a government that would be supportive but not intrusive politically into the affairs of the university, the capacity of the universities to appoint whom they wished and to succeed as they would. And this sadly has been eroded first in many ways across the sector a little bit, but in HKU in particular, because it is one in which the chief executive also serves by law as chancellor of the university and has exceptional powers in controlling the council of the university. In fairness, British governors in the latter part of British rule or chief executives in the first period after 1997 understood that to be a chancellor is to be, how should we put it, is to be honorary, is to be an honorific position, as it is in Britain and all areas of the British-influenced world. But in recent years, and particularly under the previous chief executive, or two previous chief executives, there's been much greater and direct interference into the role of the university and into its governance, something that should give one great pause. I write about this in some detail in the book and some good stories in it, so I don't want to spoil readers for it. But I think, the success and failure of a great institution of higher education depends more than anything else on how well it is governed and how well it can chart its course for the future based on the criteria set out by its faculty and academic leaders. When that comes into question, when that becomes politicized, as we have seen in some mainland universities, then, and as we saw in German universities in the 1930s and after, then everything is up for questioning.
I do want to say that the book contains lots of great stories that I very much enjoy reading, and a lot of great lines I will now be using in everyday life, including, what is it, one where you quote the minutes of a CCP meeting where, the resolution passed unanimously, though many comrades were opposed. That's a line that I'll be using to describe many of my meetings going forward. But I do want to end with kind of a big picture, kind of forward-looking question. You know, universities have had I guess to say that they've had a tough time in the past 2 years would be a grave understatement. You know, students have had to work remotely due to COVID. Travel restrictions have caused international students to dry up. Sorry, that population to dry up, which I know is blasted a hole in a lot of university budgets. Geopolitical tensions are getting in the way of intellectual exchange. I know there was the whole U.S.-China initiative that was ended earlier this year, which led to a lot of pressure on Chinese academics. A lot of academics I know would rather go home than face suspicion in the U.S., for example. So universities have had a really tough time in the past kind of 2 years. And the idea of kind of global intellectual exchange has had a really tough time in the past 2 years. Kind of what do you see, you know, as the future of the global university, whether that's in the U.S. or in China or anywhere else in the world?
And that's a great question, a really important question, Nicholas. And I think it really gets at the prospects of higher education going forward in the next several decades. The pandemic, of course, has limited interaction. You know, I oversee our center in Shanghai as a faculty member, but I have to do it remotely. For a while, that center was the only part of Harvard University that was open for real people on a regular basis. But now, as the rest of the university here has reopened, that center has been more closed than open because of the zero COVID policies in China. It's been very, very difficult. And if you take other periods of time as examples, you know, the United States and China had close intellectual and educational relations before 1949. And then these were cut off almost completely for 30 years to the benefit of neither country, certainly not to the benefit of China, but also not to the benefit of the United States. And today, we see Chinese universities growing from strength to strength, in part with very significant government funding, but also by the recruitment of Chinese scholars educated in every corner of the world, particularly in North America and in Europe, but also in Japan and in Australia and elsewhere, as well as in China. And this internationalization, this recruitment of talent is key to their strength. For a place like Harvard, if we are not able to recruit the best talent possible in the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences and in our professional schools, these are schools, so our GSAS here, the Arts and Sciences Graduate School, we recruit scholars, you know, in chemistry, in physics, in history, political science, exclusively on the basis of merit. And exclusively on the basis of merit, 45% of our graduate students are international. This university will become much less powerful and much less successful as an engine of intellectual growth if it is forced to be more parochial in its search for talent. And so we're in this moment, very sad and very dangerous moment of a beginning in the Trump years and then under President Xi in China, of a seemingly self-isolating United States, more truculent United States, and a self-isolating China, particularly once COVID entered in, but a self-isolating and a mutual paranoia between the United States and China. But I can guarantee you this, that for the world of universities, this is a recipe for decline. Universities that are not open to talent from around the world, that are not open to learn the lessons from the successes and failures of institutions from around the world, these will decline. And we know from Chinese history, if you look at the history and the catastrophe of Maoist rule, A self-isolating China is a danger to itself and an enormous loss for the world. But the same can be said also of the United States.
So with that, that ends our interview with Bill Kirby, author of Empires of Ideas, Creating the Modern University from Germany to America to China. Bill, I actually have two final questions for you, which is, where can people find your work and what's next for you?
Great question. Well, the book can be ordered, of course, from Amazon, like everything else, but also from Harvard University Press directly. There will be a regular character translation coming out of Taiwan. There will be a simplified character translation we are working on for the mainland, not yet under contract, but very optimistic that that will happen shortly. So it should be available in multiple formats. Of course, it's also available as an ebook. So I look forward to individuals having the opportunity to read it and to communicate with them about what they like and what they don't like about it. For the next year, I will be researching two different topics. One of them about higher education internationally, experiments in higher education around the world, and what the United States can learn from it. As readers of this book will know, the Americans became really good in higher education by learning from others, particularly from the Germans. Today, very few American universities look abroad for models. What are the innovations, for example, in Europe, in liberal arts and sciences education, for example, in the Netherlands, or in Britain, with the extraordinary internationalization of the red brick universities, or in Africa, or in South Asia, this extraordinary experiment of the Asian University for Women in Bangladesh, or in China, or in Hong Kong. You know, Hong Kong, for example, rather dramatically and with great success in the 334 reform, established a new general education curriculum for every Hong Kong university over the last 15 years. That's a remarkable achievement. And many of these universities have established, I think, extraordinary programs that would be worth for others to study. So that's project number one. And that's one that I have some significant optimism about. And the second one I have optimism about completing, but not optimism about the topic. The second project is beginning to look through a series of business cases and other cases on what does China look like, China's future in a deglobalizing world. My core belief as I go into this project is that China has grown and flourished when it is a part and partner of the international community, and a China that is not connected well to other leading sources of economic development, or in particularly of intellectual development, will find itself poorer as the result. That's the working hypothesis, but we shall see. And I shall do that through a series first of Harvard Business School cases, and then through some other forms of inquiry. And I'll be doing all this in the fall semester as a visiting scholar out of the University of California at Berkeley.
Oh, that all sounds very exciting and very interesting. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. The Every Podcast is on all your podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those running in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for info who's coming up on the show. But before then, Bill, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a real pleasure, Nicholas. Thank you very much. Excellent and tough questions. I really appreciate it.